David Shields believes we're living in newsy times, but that we're also living in fictitious times, that our culture is obsessed with real events because we hardly experience any. In his latest book, Reality Hunger, a Manifesto, he makes the case for bringing reality to the fore in the arts by abandoning the novel as a form, embracing nonfiction narrative, and encouraging writers and musicians to borrow from and remix the work of their predecessors. He's the author of 9 previous books, including novels, short stories, and nonfiction. He teaches literature at the University of Washington in Seattle. This book is published by Knopf. I'm very pleased that it brings David Shields back to our show today. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
As I said, you argued that our culture is obsessed with real events because we hardly experience any, but we are sitting here and talking, and we have lots of listeners who are witnesses to this event. So isn't this a real event?
This is a real event, and we do have bodies, but we live in an extraordinarily mediated and simulated and artificial culture. There's immense amounts of data streams between us and our lives. I mean, just walking around New York today, you know, everyone's tweeting and texting and IMing and Googling, and that we live in an extraordinarily mediated culture. And I think that because of that, that we're obsessed with reality, and so that we crave reality. And
but do those things keep us from reality when somebody IMs? By the way, I don't do any of those things because I'm of a certain age. But when other people do those things, aren't they connecting? Isn't that a connection to reality?
It is a kind of connection to reality, but it's a certain kind of, I mean, it's a highly mediated version of reality. And so I think that because of that in the arts, that for me, more bubble wrap, more dream world, more simulation is not going to cut through things. For instance, great line of Kafka that gets quoted a lot. Kafka says, a book must be the axe to break the frozen sea within us. And it's my contention in the book and elsewhere that given the extraordinary amount of dream world and bubble wrap that we live in, more fiction, more dream world is not going to break through that frozen sea, that we need things that evince what I call reality hunger, that try somehow to make as thin a membrane as possible between the writer and reader.
You've called this book a manifesto. We haven't seen many manifestos in recent years. Have you just kind of stated the point of the manifesto, or is it a little more complicated than that?
I mean, I hope it's more nuanced than that. I mean, I think it's at least a tripart manifesto. One part is to argue for especially writers to catch up with the other arts and to overturn the laws governing appropriation. A second one is to obliterate distinctions between fiction and nonfiction. And a third is to create new forms for a new century.
You're right. I find nearly all the moves the traditional novel makes unbelievably predictable, tired, contrived, and essentially purposeless. At least once every decade since the 1950s, someone has declared that the novel is dead or dying. It's always presented as though this is the first time the claim is being made, as though it's big news. And I remember when it was John Barth in the late 60s, Tom Wolfe said that the novel was going to die unless everybody wrote like Tom Wolfe. V.S. Naipaul declared in an interview in the New York Times that the novel was dead. But as far as I'm concerned, there's some pretty wonderful writing still going on. Margaret Atwood, Chinua Achebe, The New Yorker has a new story by Roberto Bolaño, who unfortunately died too young. Edward P. Jones, is, I think, a wonderful writer. I could probably come up with a list of 30 or 40 more.
Yeah, I would say that most of those novels bore me to death.
The people I mentioned.
Well, I haven't read all of them, or I haven't certainly read all of the works of each of those writers, but increasingly for me, the novelistic apparatus seems to me antiquated and essentially 19th century or perhaps barely 20th century. So many of the gestures of the novel, plot implying coherence, character implying a kind of bourgeois culture as our definition, setting implying that where we live matters far more than it does now, and above all, pace, that we live in an extraordinarily fast-paced culture, and our minds think with a rapidity that they never thought, and the extraordinarily glacial pace of most novels, that all those elements leave me extraordinarily bored by the vast majority of contemporary novels.
Well, for example, you say Alice Munro, one of my favorite writers, is too descriptive. But what if I would just argue that your book is just one man's opinion? You're bored by novels. I'm not bored by novels. My take is as good as your take.
Yeah, I would say sort of different strokes for different folks. Finally, it is a case of temperament. I wrote the book as a way to figure out, for me, how to go on as a writer. I'd written three novels. The novel form collapsed on me. I was bored by the form. I became a nonfiction writer. It baffled and bewildered and fascinated me that the novel form had gone extraordinarily flat on me. And for purposes of regeneration, I needed to figure out why nonfiction held extraordinary power for me. So the book really is my attempt to answer for myself and bring along what fellow travelers I can. You know, it's sort of, if you're against abortions, don't have one. You know, if you don't agree with the book, then go on writing your glacially paced novels. That's fine by me.
We've had this big debate over just what is fiction and what is nonfiction. The James Frey memoir, just one of many examples, boringly talked about way too much. But still, isn't there always a blurred line?
Well, as part of what I'm doing in the book is trying to backform a tradition. I really argue that nonfiction has never been true with a crystalline purity. Thucydides' History of the Peloponnesian War, in that book, Thucydides makes up the general speeches. That's, to me, an amazing piece of information. A founding document of Western literature and even of Western civilization, an originating work of Western history. In that work, Thucydides invents the general speeches. I think that's a fascinating piece of information. I argue strongly in this work, it's really a crucial aspect for me, nonfiction has never been true with a kind of purity that we expect it to. A big part of my argument is to argue against what I call trial by Google, in which every work of nonfiction gets vetted as if it's an article in the New York Times. I want to argue it for a nonfiction as a work of literature, of literary nonfiction, of the personal essay, of the lyric essay as a subset of literature, not as a subset of journalism. I'm trying to rescue nonfiction as art and to understand exactly, as you say, that nonfiction from the beginning of time has exercised an enormous amount of poetic license.
Well, you mentioned Thucydides. Let's talk about another Greek, Homer. The Iliad was assumed, because of all of its miracles and monsters and whatever, to be a pure act of fiction until Heinrich Schliemann went and discovered Troy, just following what the information that Homer provided.
Right. That's a fascinating account where he was able to prove that much of Homer derives from natural phenomena. I mean, I'm very interested in many novels, and in no way am I saying that we should somehow stop reading Remembrance of Things Past. A Remembrance of Things Past. But I'm arguing for me, the most exciting works of contemporary writing erase the boundaries between genres. There's a crucial line in my book where I quote Walter Benjamin, who says, all great works of literature either dissolve a genre or invent one. A big part of my argument is to say the moment you are wrapped inside a generic category such as the memoir or novel or a romantic comedy, you're tending to deliver an extraordinarily predictable thing. I'm really arguing for the excitement of genre-defying work.
And so you seem to enjoy fiction and nonfiction where the writer breaks the fourth wall, speaks directly to the reader as if trying to engage us in conversation, like Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five, Dave Eggers' heartbreaking work of staggering genius, Milan Kundera's Immortality. Each of those books, the author writes at least at some point that of actual personal experience.
Exactly. That I'm drawing. There's a wonderful line again in the book quoted from Adam Gopnik, who I believe in this context is talking about Francis Bacon. He's saying that in our time, only works of authentic disorder, only works that are raw and unfiltered, only works that are discomforting can again break through the morass. There's something about our contemporary existence that seems to demand discomfort and disorder and rawness. And it seems to me, I'm
not going to agree with Adam Gopnik. I prefer Mark Rothko to Francis Bacon.
Well, I'm a huge Rothko fan. I love Rothko, but we're talking about now. We're talking about what work can move us now. That the way that art evolves and renews itself is by destroying what goes before. When people first heard Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, they went running into the aisles screaming at the cacophony of it. So too Manet's painting, so too Ulysses, that I'm trying to argue for us not to genuflect endlessly at the altar of the 19th century novel.
So something like García Márquez would be okay with you, his magic realism?
I mean, it's not okay or not okay with me. I'm not an arbiter. I'm just trying to stay alive.
No, but I mean, would that bore you?
García Márquez is not a writer who interests me greatly. I have to say that a crucial moment of my writing life was reading Proust and García Márquez back to back. And I was so much more interested in Proust's attempt to inscape the real than I was in García Márquez's sort of dream world. I'm just arguing for a different aesthetic.
It's interesting that one of the creators of magic realism, José Donoso, the late José Donoso, told me that he rejected it after a while because it had become too formulaic and he wanted to move on.
Well, I think that's the power of Robert Bolaño's work, is that he's pushing back hard against Latin American magic realism and trying to find something that's more gritty at ground level. So much of the argument of my book is arguing precisely for, given the works of postmodernism, given the extraordinary sort of dream world and bubble wrap in which we live, that only works of authentic and raw disorder can break through the simulation.
My guest is David Shields, whose latest book is Reality Hunger, a Manifesto. It's published by Knopf. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with David Shields, who's written a lot of fiction, but now no longer believes in it. He's written a book called Reality Hunger, a Manifesto. It's published by Knopf. Was there a time a writer could get in trouble for publishing a work of fiction? You're talking about pushing at the bounds, the boundaries.
Was there a time in which a writer could get in trouble for publishing a work of fiction?
Yes.
Well, I think the origins of the novel are hugely bound up with a pretense of actuality.
Daniel Defoe used to claim that he discovered these journals.
That for a very long time, I mean, really the origins of the novel are, as I say, completely wrapped up in pretending it was an actual document. So these arguments have been going on from the beginning of time. I think that for me, I'm arguing, there's a wonderful line of David Foster Wallace who passed away a year and a half ago, but he was asked, what's so great about fiction writing? And he said, well, that we're existentially alone on the planet. I can't know what you're thinking and feeling, and you can't know what I'm thinking and feeling. And the best writing is a bridge constructed across the abyss of human loneliness. Then he went on to say, oh, well, by the way, there's all these contrivances. There's characters we have to believe in, and there's plots that seem rather dubious. But don't worry, we can get past that. And I love, of course, the first part of Wallace's answer. I want to put that at the center of what I'm about. But I can just say for myself, the second part of Wallace's answer I want to quarrel with. The core gesture for me is writing that puts at the front and center how the writer solved being alive. Nothing less and nothing more than that.
I would interpret David Foster Wallace's statement as saying that fiction, the pleasures of fiction are that at best they give us insights into ourselves and human nature. And sometimes we have to go through those contrivances to get to those insights. My complaint with postmodernism was that it often very purposely got rid of the insights, and so I didn't understand why I was just reading the babbling, as I took it, of some writer who was very clever with words.
I mean, the thing I want is nothing but the insights. I'm a sort of wisdom junkie, I think I say in the book. The works I love, Simon Gray's Smoking Diaries, Maggie Nelson's Bluets, Sarah Manguso's The Two Kinds of Decay, Amy Fusselman's The Pharmacist's Mate, Leonard Michael's Shuffle, the works I love, they put at the absolute dead core of the book the insights themselves. You know, omission is a form of creation, as David Mamet once said, that, you know, as Emerson said, you know, the line of beauty is the line of perfect economy. I want to put at the absolute center the work struggling with the writer struggling with existence.
The modern novel, as we know it, emerged in the 18th century, and you say mostly to amuse middle and upper class ladies and provide them with a sense of importance. And when I read that, I thought, were Fielding's Tom Jones or Sterne's Tristram Shandy written to amuse women?
Well, that's a standard theory of the novel. I mean, the rise of the novel, a great work by Ian Watt, is sort of the standard work on the rise of the novel.
No, we're talking about Richardson, it's true.
But in general, obviously there are exceptions. There's always exceptions that prove the rule, just as there are exceptions of novels that I really love. I love a lot. One of my favorite books of the last 15 years is J.M. Coetzee's Elizabeth Costello, which is a sort of novel barely. I love David Markson's last four novels, which again are novels just barely. I love Barry Hannah's Boomerang, again, a novel just barely. So oftentimes the exceptions, the outliers, sort of prove the rule. But to answer your question, absolutely. The core of the novel was a work to flatter the middle class, that their foibles and mores were fascinating.
Well, if Jane Austen wrote her books to amuse women, then we can all be thankful for that, can't we?
Of course. I mean, I love novels. I still read novels. I'm trying to figure out a way for writing to go forward and to compete with the visual arts, with music, with film, with video, with television. To me, the answer is not to endlessly worship at the altar of Jane Austen. Writing has to figure out a way to go forward in the completely digitized culture that we live in, and not to endlessly rewrite Jane Austen.
An interviewer for Rumpus magazine accused you of dismissing fiction as entertainment, and you said, too often it is. So what's wrong with fiction as entertainment?
Well, that we're here on ground level. We're here on planet Earth, that we are mortal beings. I'm a completely secular human being who believes this is the entire ride. And I believe that reality is all that we have. And I think, yes, human beings can tolerate only so much reality, but I think we can tolerate even less the loneliness that comes from not actually facing each other. The works that I find are absolutely compelling are those works which assuage human loneliness by actually showing me how the writer thinks and feels, that actually inscape the writer and show me how the writer solved being alive. I find those works truly mature works of art, rather than works who are hugely invested in getting the reader to turn pages, and the insights come every 93 pages. That's not sufficient, in my view.
One of the arguments you make is that art is based on copying and building on other works, and you quote Picasso, who said, "Art is theft." For how long have artists and writers been ripping each other off?
From the beginning of time, that Shakespeare's Henry the Sixth, 4,000 of the 6,000 words of Henry the Sixth, parts 1 through 3, are direct plunderings from other sources, including Plutarch's Lives. Manet's Olympia is a complete reworking of Titian's Venus of Urbino. From the Roman sculptures were direct copies of Greek sculptors. That from the history of art is a history of plagiarism.
But the greatest artists, as far as I'm concerned, are the ones who broke with those things, whether it's Leonardo or Roger van der Weyden or Caravaggio. They were the ones who shocked everybody because they didn't follow the conventions.
Well, Shakespeare, I'm not talking about following the convention. Art transforms. Art transfigures. It's what my friend and fellow writer Jonathan Lethem calls the ecstasy of influence, that writers have endlessly plundered in order precisely to break the conventions. I'm not arguing for a kind of tedious worship of the past. Art is not a patent office. It's a conversation between and among artists. And what artists have endlessly done is to create space for themselves by precisely feeding on previous artists. And so the extraordinarily litigious time in which we live handcuffs the writer. I'm trying for us to recover precisely the freedoms that everyone from Montaigne to Shakespeare to Manet to Aaron Copland to Tchaikovsky did. I mean, Tchaikovsky's 1812 overture embeds within it the French national anthem. If you were to try to do that now, we'd have 7 lawyers telling him that he couldn't do it.
So you think sampling is a good thing in hip-hop?
To say the least. Yeah, it's completely remade art. I mean, what do you think that visual arts since Duchamp has been doing? I mean, that it's to me extraordinarily odd and depressing and embarrassing that the literary arts are falling so far behind the visual arts and music. James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, published in 1939, I believe, is nothing but a tissue of quotations from previous works, and yet now we want to worry about that. I'm trying to recover for us the freedoms and risks, dangers and excitements that writers and creative artists have had from the beginning of time, but due to our extraordinarily literal-minded and litigious society, those risks and freedoms, especially for writers, are under house arrest, I think, interestingly, because both the law and literature are verbal, and somehow the law can speak literature, whereas it has trouble speaking, in a way, sort of visual arts and music.
So what are your feelings about plagiarism, whether it's historians like Doris Kearns Goodwin, or there was a recent scandal in Europe where a teenage novelist declared a genius turned out to be somebody who had ripped off whole passages from another person's book?
Well, you have to take it on a case-by-case basis. I'm not an absolutist on the issue. For instance, if you were to take, a copy of, say, the movie Titanic and walk around 42nd and Broadway and sell it as your movie, that's just simply stealing and doesn't interest me. But I became oddly conversant with many legal principles preparing to have this book published. And in my view, the three crucial terms are fair use, public domain, and the most interesting one is transformation. In your plundering, in your theft, have you transformed the earlier work? And so oftentimes people ask me, well, how would you feel if someone took a previous work of yours and stole it. I'd be thrilled that anyone found my work of stealable value. What you can't do is take an entire book of mine and publish it under your name.
We have very little time, but I wonder whether you think 100 years from now people will still be writing novels, or people be reading new novels, or just reading the novels of the past, ones you recommend.
They will be reading books. In 100 years, I haven't the faintest idea. They will definitely not be reading novels the way that we currently conceive them. That's absolutely for certain.
David Shields is the author of 9 previous books, including Black Planet, a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award, and Remote, which was a winner of the Penn Revson Award. His latest is called Reality Hunger, a manifesto. It is published by Knopf, and I'm assuming you're not working on another novel.
Actually, I am working on a third-person novel about house-sitting.
And David Shields will be part of a panel discussion tonight at 6:30 at the CUNY Graduate Center at 265 Fifth Avenue. Tickets details on our show page.